Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In 1961, Michael Rockefeller, son of then-governor of New York State Nelson Rockefeller, mysteriously disappeared off the remote coast of southern New Guinea. Amidst the glare of international public interest, the governor, along with his daughter Mary, Michael's twin, set off on a futile search, only to return empty-handed and empty-hearted. What followed were Mary's 27-year repression of her grief and an unconscious denial of her twin's death, which haunted her relationships and controlled her life. In her moving memoir, When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a memoir of losing a twin, Mary Rockefeller Morgan struggles to claim an individual identity which enables her to face Michael's death and the huge loss it engendered. In the book, she shares her healing journey and her story of moving forward into a life of new beginnings and meaning, especially in her work with others who have lost a twin. It is a pleasure to welcome Mary Rockefeller Morgan back to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yes, it's nice to be here again. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. You were with us when this book came out in hardcover, and now it is out in paperback, and it's a delight to have you back on the program.
Well, thank you.
Has anything changed in that time? Has the story changed for you?
Yes. You know, it's interesting that you asked that, because I received many letters from people. I received letters from people who are twins, who lost twins, and that was extremely touching and wonderfully heartwarming for me. But then what happened is I received letters from people who were not twins. And those people were, you know, connected to the story that I told and to the description of what the issues are around deep personal loss, and they really felt a connection to what I had gone through in terms of their own struggle to heal from deep personal loss. So that I really felt like it would be important for me to enlarge the focus of the book. And I wrote an epilogue which does that, and I also changed the name of the book. I changed it to, it's now called When Grief Calls Forth the Healing. And I really wanted to call it that, Joe, because I think that kind of immediately connects into the one of the great sadnesses and misunderstandings that we have about the grieving process and the fact that in our culture we don't give, you know, we repress grief and we deny death. And we give very little time for the grieving process, and also we don't make a tremendous effort to make that process safe for the person who is struggling with the loss.
I want to, there's a lot I want to talk about, but let me just grasp onto what you just said of making it safe. How do we make it safe?
Well, I think one of the ways we make it safe, really, I think the word connection is a beautiful word, because we really heal in connection. And we heal in connection to ourselves, and that means that making it safe means beginning to trust and respect our feelings, whatever they are, and know that those feelings that come up and the places where we have no feelings in the beginning and then the places where those feelings come in waves and change, those are all natural, and we need to be respectful and really own those feelings and express them in some way. And the next thing, I think, is we need to respect the time it takes to heal. The deeper the loss, the more time it takes. You know, loss is a natural thing, and the most extraordinary thing is that we're very aware of how we heal physically when we are wounded. You know, you get a cut on your hand, you can actually see that scab forming, and you know that there's an inner system within you that is healing that wound, and that you're going to, you know, you can see that and feel that and know that's going to happen. People are not aware that they have a natural healing process that comes into being. And so part of feeling safe is being in a place where one can connect to that natural healing process in a safe way, that is either being with other people, finding a group of other people that are experiencing deep personal loss so that you are together and in connection with other people who understand what's happening to you, or finding a personal therapist, a bereavement specialist of some kind who really understands. For twins, this is a huge issue because so many people don't understand what happens to twins and the enormous, the enormity of the loss that they have. And so getting together with other twins is extremely important. We have something in this country called the Twinless Twin Support Group International,
right.
TTSGI, which is a fabulous group that has smaller regional groups all over the country and meets in conference once for a week, once a year, where we get together in healing sessions, and that helps tremendously. And so then it's also important, I think, to be aware in terms of the natural world. Many of us are so separated from the natural world, and so we don't see that life and death is part of our existence. Mm. And when we love, if we get to be 40, 45 in our whatever in our lives, and sometimes much earlier, we're going to lose somebody that we love. And so we need to be aware that that's a natural thing and that we have a natural place within us to deal with that so that we can heal from that.
Do you feel that you lost time with the repression in the sense of that, that there was a loss of time in grieving that you could have had, or do you look at it as, no, that was just all part of the grieving process?
Well, I think for me there was two things. One is that my brother was never found.
Right.
So he disappeared.
Which is huge, because you never know.
That's right. So that dealing with not knowing, and there's been a lot of stories about how he was found and he was killed and even cannibalized, and there's a book out now that's all about that. And the truth is, Joe, is that there has never been any direct or conclusive evidence as to how Michael died. And so that I and my family are left with the not knowing. And so many people in this world are left in that place. When we think of the Malaysian aircraft, think of those people who are struggling with not knowing what happened to their loved ones, and the people in that ferry disaster in South Korea, the people in the mudslide,
right.
You know, in Oso, Washington, and all the wars that have happened, and our 9/11, all those people, so many of them never know exactly what happened to their loved ones. So that piece was a big one for me, that learning to live with not knowing. And I found that what I had to do is that I had to grieve the not knowing. That was a loss in itself, the having no closure. And that had to be grieved in itself. So that was a big piece, and that took a lot of time. Then the denial, which you were talking about, the repression, which often is it's an adaptive thing that happens as part of the grieving process in the beginning, because we're not ready to take in the enormity of the loss.
Right.
And what are we doing when we're grieving? When we're grieving, we are slowly acknowledging and integrating the loss of that physical connection to that person. And in doing that we are not losing. The great misunderstanding is that we're losing the relationship. We're not losing the relationship. The relationship has to transform. And the grieving actually is, it's preparing the soil of our hearts to receive that relationship in our hearts, which belongs to us forever, and so that it can be there as a nurturing experience for us without pain. But we must grieve this loss of the physical connection. And the denial for me lasted much too long because nobody understood, one, how long it was going to take me as a twin.
Right.
Because I mean, that's another fascinating issue that I go into in the book, is this whole issue of twin loss, which has to do with the twin bond. And the twin bond is begun and thrives in the womb way before we're born. In that 9 months, you're literally conceived in relationship to another human being, and you grow in relationship. And little fetuses are, the little twin fetuses are reaching out to each other in connection at 14 weeks of age. They've seen this in sonograms. So there is an enormous twin bond, whether you're fraternal or whether you're identical, that has developed by the time you're born. And then after that, it depends on how you are in relationship to your parents or the loved ones that take care of you.
Right.
How do they relate to the twins? Do they give the twins opportunity to find out who they are as individuals, or do they just relate to them as an entity?
I ask this question because I think, because you have received so much mail from people and have talked to people, and there is the similarity of the twins, there is a similarity of a great loss that people write to you about.
Yes.
But also, let's add to this the spotlight that you are in.
That's exactly right.
You are the daughter of the governor of the state of New York. You are a Rockefeller. So there is this incredible media spotlight, which quite frankly is still on you. It still sells books, so the people write new versions of the story of your brother, and so that never goes away, which seems to me that it would slow the process.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the blessed thing for me is that I, even though it took as long as it did, that this natural healing and process within me, which I call a natural healing imperative, because I think it wants you, I think there is an inner imperative that wants you to be able to heal. And I know that in the denial period, that, you know, the huge 27 years, I mean, my therapist, you know, said, Mary, it's time to move on with your life. We hadn't even approached what was going on in terms of the loss of my twin. He felt that because I was a fraternal twin, that I wasn't even a real twin.
Mm.
And that my genetic relationship to my twin brother was the same as a sibling, and therefore the bond couldn't be any stronger than a sibling bond. And I think there's very big misunderstanding about sibling loss anyway, but I also think that this was really pushed me to repress the grief even more, because here was this great authority, and in the 60s, you know, I mean, women really hadn't come into themselves in being able to claim who they were in their own right. They were just beginning. You know, the literature was coming into being in the 70s, and women were, you know, really stepping forward to claim themselves as individuals and people who were intelligent and could do and become in this society of ours, other than just being mothers and sexual objects. So there was a lot for me to have to deal with, and this being in the spotlight, especially in New Guinea when I went there to search for Michael, it just was a terribly isolating thing for me, and a frightening thing. And it didn't connect me to what was naturally supposed to happen. I also, when I came home, my mom, you know, where I would have been coming home into the shelter of her arms and be able to begin that grieving process and cry, she said, because of the spotlight and because of the governorship and her role and her responsibility, sense of responsibility, she said to me, Mary, the one thing we cannot do is cry.
Wow.
And that was just she did that out of a very loving sense of what was right to do, and it was a complete and total mistake.
Right. Do you think about how your brother would have handled, and of what you write about, in the dealing with the death, of how your brother would have handled it if it had been you who had been lost.
How he would have handled my death?
Yes.
Well, you know, that's so fascinating because Michael, and I think that Michael, well, he was a very, even though we were very closely connected, he was a very different personality than me.
Mm.
I mean, Michael was very self-contained in the nicest, gentlest way. He wasn't really connected to the storm and drung of the family relationship. You know, we were five siblings, and so we were always arguing and you know, going back and forth at like most kids.
Right.
And Michael was always, you know, interested in what was going on around him, but not so much in terms of personal interaction. He was fascinated with beautiful things and what he saw, and he was always interested in talking to us about what was happening in his world. But he was not connected to the, you know, to the kind of emotional situations that were revolving around, whereas I was always interested in who would, you know, who was being bullied or who was in trouble, and I was standing up for the underdog, and I would get in trouble with my family because I would say, no, this is not what's happening, it's really that's happening. And, you know, and Michael was just not connected. He it seemed to me in a way, Joe, that he was an old soul.
Yeah.
That he was born an old soul. He'd been here. He'd either had, you know, I don't know what you feel about other lives or how all of this, everybody has a special way of looking at the life. But it felt like Michael's life was completed in those 23 years. And if I had died, I mean, he loved me deeply. And I don't, to answer you honestly, I don't know. I know it would have been a tragedy for him.
Hmm.
But it almost seems like I can't go there.
Right.
Because what has happened was, I feel, is meant to happen. I was meant to laugh. I was meant to learn how to grow and develop my own sense as an individual. And it was difficult to do that as a twin who was so closely bonded. And so that I've been able to, it's a beautiful thing that I can hold Michael's relationship in my heart now and without pain, because I have done the grieving. These stories that are still being talked about Michael and still being written about, I'm not saying they're not difficult. It's painful for the family to have to revisit the scenarios of how he died, because he lost his life off the coast of New Guinea. His boat capsized. He had 10 miles about to swim to shore in terrible waters off a terribly remote jungle coast with a huge current that was carrying his boat out to sea and down the coast, and it capsized, and finally they had no water, no food, nothing, and he realized that the only way to save him and this other man who was the anthropologist with him was for him to swim.
Mm.
So no one has ever seen him since he disappeared swimming to shore. And so those scenarios are difficult to revisit. But because I have done my grieving, and because I have really visited the place of Michael as a person and how he met his death, I believe he met his death with great courage. And I believe his death is a very important moment in his life, but it is only one moment.
Mm.
And what is really important is his whole life.
And I think it just seemed like a beautiful image of what you just said, that even though it was short and shortened, that you, through your grieving, you have a feeling of peace because you feel that he led a very full life.
I do. And I feel that you know, that the sense of life as it goes forward after death is very personal. And some people don't believe at all that it goes forward. I believe that Michael's spirit is present for me within my heart, and I can feel him there, and I also can feel him, and I write about this in the book as to how he's, the gift of him has really been able to be felt and experienced by me in my life. I have so much more courage now and so much more ability to claim and to, you know, to actually experience something new and exciting, where I always held back when we were little. Mm-hmm. And he was always the one who would go out and be the adventure someone. And now I feel that that gift he's given me. And that's just a beautiful thing. And so these books and these stories, as sad and painful as they are, they can't rob me of that. They really can't.
Well, your book is beautiful. It is When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a Memoir of Losing a Twin. It is published by Open Road. It is just out in paperback. Mary Rockefeller Morgan, it's always a delight to speak to you. I thank you so much for sharing with us and for being so candid. It's a great pleasure always to speak to you.
Thank you, Joe. And can I just say one thing?
Of course.
And that is that there's a slight, you know, week, I think, time at which Amazon has had a glitch. So if anybody's looking for Amazon for my book, I would recommend that they go to Barnes & Noble or to their local bookstore for the next week, because there is this glitch which says you can't get the book for four to eight weeks, which
but
is absolutely not true.
It's there. All right. And we'll send people out to their independent bookstores, and they can find it there as well.
And also on Barnes & Noble and on website, and that will be fixed within a week, I'm sure.
Excellent. Again, the title of the book, When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a Memoir of Losing a Twin. Mary Rockefeller Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
A great pleasure.
Bye-bye,
thank
now.
You. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.